Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Judith Brown Deanis, co-director of the Advancement Project, who discusses why the jury verdict in the Trayvon Martin murder trial has provoked many Americans to examine persistent racial prejudice in our country. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace and author of the book Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control, who talks about growing opposition to U.S. drone programs at home and abroad. And Reverend Rick Hoyt of the First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles, who explains why his congregation joined a lawsuit to halt the government's dragnet surveillance of U.S. citizens' phone and internet communications. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Russia's most vocal anti-corruption activist and blogger, Alexei Navalny, a critic of President Vladimir Putin, was sentenced to 5 years in jail for embezzling from a state-run timber company. The stiff sentence was immediately condemned by human rights groups, the European Union, and the United States. After street protests in Moscow, Navalny was released pending his appeal. The opposition activist pledged to continue his candidacy for mayor of Moscow in an election this September, even though his conviction prevents him from seeking public office. Navalny emerged out of the protests against voter fraud after the 2011 Russian parliamentary election. Observers noted a mix of motives in releasing Navalny, including a possible desire by Kremlin insiders for the blogger to be beaten badly in the Moscow election by acting mayor Sergei Sobyanin. The sentencing comes as Putin is under heavy pressure from the Obama White House to hand over intelligence whistleblower Edward Snowden, who is stranded in the transit zone at Moscow's airport as he seeks temporary asylum in Russia and permanent asylum elsewhere. Russian economist and Navalny supporter Sergei Guriev says the five-year sentence was clearly political, noting, "Everyone reads his blog. He is the face of the opposition. What happens to him determines the future of Russia." As the United States Supreme Court was deliberating the fate of the Voting Rights Act, Colorado state legislators were expanding voting rights by establishing Election Day and portable registration. The reform bill passed in May also expands the popular mail-in voting system, which includes every registered voter in the state. According to the news magazine In These Times, these voting reforms capped off a big year for Colorado progressive legislators, who enacted a stiff new gun control law, approved gay civil unions, and created a system for legalizing marijuana. This year, Colorado was one of the few states to expand voter rights in the face of right-wing opposition. In late June, the Supreme Court, in the case Shelby County versus Holder, struck down key provisions of the Federal Voting Rights Act. The ruling voided the powers of the U.S. Justice Department to pre-approve or reject changes in voting procedures in selected states. For years, conservatives have complained about the Colorado model, where progressive nonprofit groups have won key legislation, as Democratic Party activists work to expand the electorate, including boosting the Latino vote. With new voting reforms, the liberal New Era Colorado Foundation proclaimed, "Colorado just got itself a 21st century inclusive election system." On July 8th, thousands of California prison inmates launched an extended hunger strike, the third in 2 years, to protest the use of solitary confinement to house gang members. 2 weeks into the hunger strike, nearly 2,000 inmates continued to refuse food, and the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation put increasing pressure on hunger strike organizers at the maximum security Pelican Bay State Prison. According to the Los Angeles Times, 14 inmates at Pelican Bay were placed in new isolation quarters, cutting them off from the news media. Prison guards also seized some legal papers of inmate organizers, which were later returned. Oakland civil rights lawyer Ann Wiles has accused prison authorities of lowering the temperature in inmate cells, making daily life increasingly uncomfortable and dangerous for hunger strikers. Jules Lobel of the Center for Constitutional Rights predicted a longer hunger strike, since Governor Jerry Brown has failed thus far to fulfill his pledge to fix the prison system's overcrowding crisis. The state of California is under a court order to reduce the prison population by 10,000 inmates a year. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
Another chapter in the tragic February 26, 2012 shooting death of unarmed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin by volunteer neighborhood watch captain George Zimmerman was written with the July 13th jury verdict that acquitted Zimmerman. Many people across the U.S. and the world were stunned by the jury's decision, given that Zimmerman had been the one to pursue the black teenager against police instructions, provoking whatever physical altercation that ensued. 1 week after the verdict, protests were organized in more than 100 U.S. cities and towns, where thousands of people of all races came together to express their anger over the acquittal and demand federal charges be brought against George Zimmerman for his violation of Martin's civil rights. Federal prosecutors are now investigating the case, but many legal observers feel that civil rights charges are unlikely. President Obama weighed in on the outcome of the court case in candid remarks made before the White House press corps on July 19th, where he spoke about Martin's unnecessary death, his own and many African Americans' experience with racial profiling, as he questioned Florida's Stand Your Ground gun law and similar measures adopted in more than 30 states. Your reporter spoke with Judith Brown Dionis, co-director of the Advancement Project, a multiracial civil rights group, who discusses why the jury verdict in the Trayvon Martin murder trial has provoked many Americans to examine and confront persistent racial prejudice in the nation.
Like many people across the country, I was very disappointed by the outcome. I think, you know, this case really is symbolic for many African Americans in this country. Trayvon was symbolic of young black men and how they're treated in this country. It shows kind of the precariousness of their lives. Too many young black men who, innocently unarmed young black men that have been killed many times because they are young black men walking down the street, you know, usually by law enforcement, this time by an individual. And for many African Americans, you know, there is this moment when you have a son where you get to the point where you have to have what we call the talk. And the talk is really about warning them about what to do if you get stopped by the police because you're a black male. Put your hands on the steering wheel. Make sure you don't make a move. Make sure you don't look a certain way at a police officer, et cetera, because we know too often young men who innocent young men have been killed. And so this was symbolic, and it was also kind of like a step backwards, because while we have been concerned about law enforcement racially profiling, now we have someone who was just on the street who followed a young man who had nothing but Skittles and an iced tea. And so now the question is, well, now what do you tell your son about preparing to be a young black male in this country? And I think that the disappointment comes with the sense of so many times we've seen this story repeated, and that there was some hope that just this once we would see justice done. Just this once young men could feel safe again and not feel that they could be gunned down innocently. And so I think for many people, quite devastating, shows how far we have to go. You know, we've made so much progress in this country, but too many young men, black and Latino, have felt the brunt of racial profiling. And, you know, when you think about it, we have not only racial profiling, but we have Muslim people in this country who are profiled. We have people who are gay who get profiled in this country and followed and treated differently because of their status. And so I think this was a really scary moment for a lot of people who wanted to believe that we had progressed.
Judith, I also wanted to ask you about President Obama's comments just short of a week after the jury acquitted George Zimmerman in the Trayvon Martin murder case. President Obama surprised the press corps in Washington and came out and made some very personal and candid comments about the trial and the circumstances surrounding the murder of Trayvon Martin and the trial in general, but some of the larger issues about race in this country, which are far from resolved. What did you make of President Obama's comments and his thoughts on this?
I mean, I think it was a watershed moment for racial politics in our country. To have an African-American president be able to speak to his own experience with racial profiling, I think it gives some credibility to the lived experience of many people of color who have experienced that. To have the person who is considered to be the world leader having to tell about his own experiences with racial profiling really should wake up people to the fact that it exists and that it is problematic, but not only that it's problematic, but that it really does dehumanize people. I think that it was an important moment for the country. I think it's a moment that should help us towards healing. I think that there were things that I would have wanted him to say, some of the things that probably should have been pointed out or be things like, you know, the fact when he talked about some of the data, that in fact the reason that we have some of these disparities in the criminal justice system are because, you know, communities of color are over-policed, that we have laws that create these disparities in convictions, such as disparities in crack cocaine sentencing policies in this country, that the war on drugs really has been a war on drugs that has been fought in communities of color solely. And so that data and the outcomes for people of color really is deeper than just the data. And so I think that was one of the things that was missing from the discussion that probably should have happened.
That was Judith Brown Dionis, co-director of the Advancement Project. Find more analysis of the Trayvon Martin murder trial and racial profiling on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Drones were in the news again as Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula last week confirmed the death of its second-in-command in Yemen, Saeed al-Shahiri, by a U.S. drone strike. While President Obama and many Americans support the use of drones to target terrorists, a growing number of people in the U.S. and around the world take a different view. Medea Benjamin is an outspoken peace activist and opponent of drone warfare. As co-founder of the group Code Pink Women for Peace more than a decade ago, she has led innumerable protests both inside official government hearings and outside on the street. She has led delegations of women and men to many of the world's hotspots, including Israel, Palestine, and Iraq and Iran. In recent years, she has traveled to the nations where U.S. drone strikes have been carried out, including Pakistan and Yemen. Her newest book is titled Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. In a talk July 14th in New Haven, Connecticut, Benjamin noted that only 2% of those killed by drones were on the U.S. government's high-value target list, such as al-Shahiri. The majority of those killed by drones, she says, were deemed militants, a term describing any male of fighting age found in the regions where the drone strikes occur. In addition, hundreds of women and children have also been killed by drones. While Benjamin expresses concern that drone technology is proliferating around the world, she's also encouraged that the movement to stop the use of weaponized drones is also building.
So one has to ask the question, how is it that the United States gets away with going anywhere it wants, killing anybody it wants, on the basis of secret information? And what if any other country in the world were doing this to us? It would be a declaration of war. There are now over 70 countries that have some kind of drone, the majority of them for surveillance purposes, but so were our lethal drones for surveillance drones until we weaponize them. And there are many countries that have already or are in the process of weaponizing their drones. We also have to think about what's going to happen when our skies are full of drones. And there's only one reason why they are not right now, and that is because the Federal Aviation Administration is in charge of our airspace, and they know that these drones crash all the time. They know that these drones don't have the same kind of visibility as piloted drones have. But in the good old American fashion, the drone manufacturers have created a strong lobby group, and that lobby group now has its own drone caucus in Congress, and that drone caucus in Congress has pushed through legislation that says by the year 2015, the U.S. airspace must be opened up to drones. In the meantime, the FAA has given out special permits to different groups, government agencies, companies, universities, to experiment with drones. But the drone manufacturers are really looking at the police departments because they understand that there are 18,000 police departments in the United States, and they want to sell drones to each and every one of them. And you can imagine after the Boston bombing, the kind of advertising campaign that the drone manufacturers have done with the police stations. So there are dozens of police stations that are now, they're testing out the drones. And these police departments, you know, are having a lot of cutbacks in their budgets right now. Well, Homeland Security has come forward and giving out grants to these police departments. So what can we do about all of this? Well, the positive thing is that there is a lot going on. On the local level, there are already communities, individual communities, that are passing no drone resolutions. We want to tell you about some of these initiatives that you can do right here in your own community. Pass a resolution that says a moratorium until we know how these drones are going to be used, or get the ACLU and other groups involved in writing the regulations for the use of these drones. And at the statewide level, there are many states that are involved right now in doing just that. Of course, the drone lobby comes in and tries to lobby. They would say, but this is jobs, jobs, jobs. That's why we need from the grassroots a voice coming up and saying, no, we already live in a country that is way too involved in spying on us. We do not want drones overhead that will turn this into a 24/7 surveillance society, and could possibly even weaponize drones and use them against us here at home. This movement has really grown tremendously in the last year. In February of 2012, 83% of Americans said it was just fine to use these weapons. Well, in the past year, there has been a dramatic shift in public opinion, so that the last opinion poll came out and said that there were 56% of the American people. That's a tremendous drop in numbers. And I think it's because of the work that people around this country have been doing to try to dispel the myth that these drones are so precise, that these drones are making us safer. There are protests at bases all over the United States now where the drones are being piloted. There are protests at the headquarters of the manufacturers of the drones. There are weekly protests at the headquarters of the CIA, at the Pentagon, in front of the White House, and in the offices of Congress itself, because Congress has done nothing to do the oversight that it's supposed to do. We're also encouraged now that finally the faith-based community that has been so silent about this has started to stir. I feel that this is one of the great moral and ethical issues of our time, and that we really have to get the faith-based community talking about the drones. There's also the beginnings of a movement at the universities, where universities are starting to do research about what kind of connections are there between their engineering departments and the military in the research of these drones.
That was an excerpt of a talk given by Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin at New Haven Center Church on July 14th. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Learn more about growing opposition to the U.S. drone warfare program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Former NSA contractor Edward Snowden who last month leaked details to newspapers about the U.S. spy agency's massive collection of domestic and overseas phone and internet communication records, remains in legal limbo at Moscow's international airport. The Obama administration had revoked Snowden's U.S. passport shortly before charging the 30-year-old former government defense contractor with three felonies, including espionage, theft, and conversion of government property. Now it appears that Russia may soon grant Snowden authorization to leave the airport transit zone where he's been stranded for a month and move to new quarters in downtown Moscow. Although the governments of Venezuela, Bolivia, and Nicaragua have all stated they would grant Snowden political asylum, none of these nations are served by direct commercial flights from Moscow. While recent public opinion polls suggest that the majority of the nation believe Edward Snowden to be a whistleblower and not a traitor, with large numbers of citizens saying that the government's anti-terrorism efforts go too far in restricting civil liberties, congressional leaders of both parties have allowed few challenges to the national surveillance state. But Republican Representative Justin Amash of Michigan is expected to introduce an amendment on July 24th that would end government authority for the blanket collection of communications records under the Patriot Act. On the legal front, the Electronic Frontier Foundation initiated a lawsuit on July 16th to halt the U.S. National Security Agency's massive collection of Americans' phone and internet data. The lawsuit includes a broad coalition of 19 plaintiffs, from civil liberties activists to church leaders and drug and gun rights advocates. Your reporter spoke with one of the plaintiffs, Reverend Rick Hoyt, minister of the First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles, who explains why his congregation joined the Electronic Frontier Foundation NSA lawsuit.
The lawsuit is organized by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and they have been a leading watchdog group for keeping the internet free and for freedom of electronic communications generally since 1990 is when they were founded. So they had already started different legal actions against the Patriot Act and parts of government spying. They were beginning to work on a kind of unique legal argument that talked about the impact that the NSA actions has on organizations rather than individuals. And so they started to look for organizations that agreed with their legal argument and that would put together a group of organizations to be part of the lawsuit. So they were aware of our church and our social justice history and our political action through various public stances that we've taken on different issues, and they actually came to us through a lawyer who is a Unitarian member of the San Diego Church. He also thought of us and recommended that we be involved in the lawsuit. So that's how we got involved in the lawsuit, and that's how our name got attached to the lawsuit, which is First Unitarian Church versus NSA.
Well, how does the sometimes controversial stands and actions your church takes relate to this lawsuit in terms of the fallout of massive spying in Americans' communications and the involvement of people in your church working on social justice issues?
Well, the argument is for this lawsuit is that all individual citizens in the U.S. have a guaranteed right to freedom of assembly. It's guaranteed in the First Amendment of the Constitution. And so we have the ability to join our individual voices together through institutions and organizations of any kind that we like in order to amplify our individual voices to make political change in the country. That's one of our guaranteed foundational freedoms. So when you have an organization like the First Unitarian Church or People for the American Way, or the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, which are all parties to this suit, who people are aware of take these controversial kinds of political stances, there's a legitimate fear that an organization like that might be under surveillance by the U.S. government. And in fact, you can point to our history that our church actually has been, and quite possibly still is. But whether it is or is not, a person may be fearful that them by having contact with that organization, if that organization is under surveillance and calls that organization is making is under surveillance, that if they begin to associate with that organization, that they may then subject themselves to increased scrutiny that they'd rather avoid. And therefore, the current actions of the NSA have a chilling effect on a person's ability to freely associate with the organizations they want to be involved in. And that's in clear violation of their First Amendment right. And that's the argument that the EFF is going to be making in this lawsuit to overturn the legislation.
Now, it's part of the same debate really revolves around security versus liberty and privacy. And we hear President Obama and other officials make the case that with the threats of terrorism, evidence since 9/11, that Americans have to be prepared to give up a certain amount of their privacy and liberty in order to prevent future catastrophic terrorist attacks like we saw on September 11, 2001. How do you respond to the idea that there, you know, there may be a balance needed, but the government's saying, you know, there's some sacrifice that needs to be made here?
Well, I think I absolutely agree. There does need to be a balance, and I'm certainly willing to make certain kinds of sacrifices or legitimate sacrifices for security. But my argument is, and the argument of my church is that we have not found a balance. In fact, we're way over on the scale of security, and I would say we've fallen into the levels of paranoia about our security, and have been willing to sacrifice the kinds of fundamental freedoms that actually are what I love about the U.S. and what makes me proud to be an American. And if we're willing to throw out the Constitution in order to feel safe from terrorism, then I'd say that we've already lost that battle.
Reverend Hoyt, I also wanted to ask you about your views of Edward Snowden, the former contract worker with the NSA who revealed a lot of what we know about the massive surveillance of Americans' communications. He's been vilified by many in the media and some in government. What do you think about him? Is he a hero or a villain or, neither?
I don't know if I have an opinion about Edward Snowden himself. I think the service that he ended up bringing by bringing some of the secrecy of this program to light is certainly important. But whether his actions in particular characterize him personally as a hero or a villain in the story, I don't know. I think, unfortunately, some of the media attention about Edward Snowden has obscured what we really ought to be talking about, which is the government surveillance program itself. He's a better story, and it's better, it's more dramatic to talk about him flying around the world trying to find asylum somewhere. But it also prevents us from actually talking about the important discussion about finding this balance between legitimate security interests and protecting the constitutional rights of our citizens.
That was Reverend Rick Hoyt, minister of the First Unitarian Church of Los Angeles, one of 19 plaintiffs in the Electronic Frontier Foundation NSA lawsuit. For more news and commentary on challenges to the NSA surveillance program, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.